Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
So you all went to college together?
Oh, yes, yeah. We were inseparable.
Yeah. Princess birthday girl!
Well, what you are listening to are a lot of actors having a lot of fun. In a show called Southern Gothic, which is playing over at Windy City Playhouse. And I got to tell you, when the show first opened, I did not have time to get over to see it. I thought, oh, darn, I'm going to miss this. I don't want to miss it. But, hey, there's just no way that I'm going to get this in. And then it's been extended and extended and extended because it is such an incredible show. So, yes, I got over to see it. And I'm hoping that all of you listening to the podcast will get over to see it because it's an incredible experience. Oh, yeah, this is Paul Lisnick. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. We're going to have some theater going on this week. So this show, Southern Gothic, really different. Unique, and let's talk about it. Joining me is the playwright, the woman responsible for writing this thing, Leslie Leotode, joins me. Leslie, thank you for joining me for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There are many actors in this show. I would have been happy with talking to anybody because they're all so great, but I kind of had a secret hope that I would get the actress who's playing Suzanne, and we got her, Carly Pollack. Carly, thank you for joining me. What a great performance you put on.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
And David Bell, we'll talk about the challenges as a director you have, because I don't know how you direct 17 shows going on at one time in various rooms all at the same time, and we, the audience, got to figure it out. I'll explain all of this to them.
I look forward to talking about it.
All right. Well, Leslie, let me start with you. You wrote it, so talk to me about what Southern Gothic is and how you got this inkling to create a show that actually goes on in several different places at the same time in a house that's been created on the stage, and the audience wanders around. We'll get all this clear, but let me start with your mission.
Okay, this actually started from another script that I had written about 10 years ago. And our artistic director, Amy Rubenstein, had read it a few years back. And it's now a couple of years ago. She called me in very late at night and said, I have an idea. I want to take the script that you wrote, and I want to stage it as an immersive show. And I kind of stared at the wall for a moment and thought, this is a little nuts. I'm not sure how this can be done. But sure, let's go for it. It could be fun. I loved Amy. I and trusted her and thought, if nothing else, we're going to have a great time on this endeavor together. So the plot of the script is a 40th birthday party set in 1960 Georgia, and it revolves around eight friends that go back to childhood together, and slowly as drinks are poured during the night, secrets are revealed.
And they are poured, by the way.
And they are poured, and they're poured to the cast members. Well, that's not actual alcohol, but then they are poured to audience members as well.
And that is actual alcohol. That is
alcohol. Yes, you have an option, but for the most part, yes, they are. And so what we ended up doing was taking this script and ripping it apart and rewriting it for an immersive production, which it was like looking at an impressionist painting when you're up close to the script and in the depths of it. It made no sense whatsoever. But when you step back, we thought, oh, this might actually work. And I really knew we had something when Amy called me and said, you won't believe this, but David Bell agreed to direct the show. And that, to me, I had my first moment of, we might actually pull this off. This might actually work if we've got David on board. And I worked on the script for about a year, reworking it. And we did our first workshop, I think at the end of it all, David, Amy, our dramaturg, Carl Menninger, we all looked at each other and our jaws were on the floor and said, this worked. I can't believe it. This timed out. It worked. And then on top of it, we've been so blessed with incredible actors that have been able to pull off a really tough show. It's a very, you know, I'll let Carly get into it, but it's a hard show when you are passing audience members that are, you know, less than a foot away from you.
Oh, my God. It's so true. And by the way, I'll just say this, which is there are several plot lines. There's kind of a, I'm not even sure if it's an A plot, B plot, but there are several parallel plot lines going on that you've got to be able to follow. So let's go to David Bell, the director. And David, of course, you've been a professor. I know you're at Northwestern, and I think you've received 8,000 Joseph Jefferson Award nominations. at least I know you won 11 of them, but you've done such great work. So this comes as a challenge to you. And my guess is one of the first things you had to do was look at some scene or set designers and go, build me a house.
Yeah, a wonderful designer named Scott Davis, who I think is a true genius. And I have had the pleasure of working together over about 6 or 7 years. And he was my first thought. He is my favorite designer to work with. And as soon as we got in a room together, he started to see how this world of the show could emerge. And I love the job he did. I think that partly his solutions to the set are things that made the storytelling so much easier and the whole show much easier for me to direct.
And so we have this set. There's a living room. There's a dining room. There's a kitchen. There's an outside backyard, if you will, or side yard. And indeed, when you arrive, you actually the curtain kind of opens. You walk through an open way. And there you are outside the house, soon to realize you're going to be stepping into the house and exploring the various rooms. So, Carly, you get to play a part of what's clearly an ensemble cast. You're all standouts, but you work so well together. Everybody's got the Southern accent, the 1960s Southern accent. Look, there's something about your character that really, I don't know, I just found really intriguing, very fun. Talk to my listeners about the various characters and a little bit about
very
Suzanne.
Sweet. Thank you. yes, but a true ensemble, I would say. Most of us are on stage. The entrances are scattered, but we all remain on stage in the house the entire show.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not like you enter and then you exit and you get time to drink water or catch your breath. It's just you're in it to win it from the top of the show. So we all depend on each other. We all cover for each other. And it is one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had the privilege of having, I will say.
What's so interesting, and we, the audience, are told before we get there, you are invisible to the actors. They will pay no attention to you. So actually, Carly, let me ask you, because people are idiots. Do you have nights where you have some of these members just trying to talk to you? I mean, I can't imagine there aren't people that try and break that wall down. Do they do it, and what do you do about it?
They absolutely do. And I don't know, you know, if there's drinks flowing. Windy City has a full bar, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But yes, people come in and, you know, they can have drinks throughout. They can exit to go to the hedge bar, which is off the back porch. There are drinks poured during the show. So people will, whether they know they're doing it or not, they will try to break down that fourth wall, which is a very strange fourth wall on this show because it's kind of it encompasses the actor. The fourth wall is all around the actor's person, basically, as they walk around the house. Because we are not, you know, we try not to make eye contact with the audience, but we know they're there. They're inches from you. So people will, you know, they get in your way, whether, you know, they don't mean to, but, and we expect that, but we do have to kind of, we do a little dance around the audience members, and we do our best to stay focused in the show, in the action, stick with our story, and try not to let them break our concentration, which is at times very difficult, but for the most part, we succeed.
And there are stagehands who are around kind of moving us out of the way.
Yes.
So if you're standing in a doorway where they know someone has got to move down, they will
Absolutely.
Whisk you away. Yeah, so that stuff works really great. Whose idea was it, brilliant as it is? I'll pose the question to you. The notion of, you know what? Obviously, it's a party. It's a 40th birthday party. Let's feed the audience, too, and let's give them drink. And when I say feed, you're not getting filet mignon. It's all snacky food. And by the way, beautifully written into the script, because the whole idea is the caterer can't make it. So what do we have around the house to serve people? Cheese and crackers, right? So Leslie, was that your idea to say, let's serve the audience, or was it a David thing?
You know, it was actually, and I have to say, for the bulk of this production, one of the things that made it so unusual was how collaborative this entire production was from beginning to end. The hours and hours and hundreds of hours that we all spent together with our heads bent, it would, you know, ideas were popping up here and there like, hey, why don't we try this? Hey, why don't we try this? And this is such an unusual show, a plot-driven show that is being staged as an immersive piece. We didn't really have any prior experience with how to do this. So it almost gave us more freedom to come up with random ideas and go for it and try it because there was no precedent set. Mm. So I will say we had several ideas that were thrown out, different ones about food. The food did change as we decided to offer it to the audience and going through the different scenarios of, okay, what if we use egg rolls? What if we, you know, then the theater is going to smell like egg rolls, you know, from the time they open to close. So it came about very organically. I guess that's a long way of saying I don't even remember now because we, as a group, sat down and ideas would just pop up in the middle of rehearsals, in the middle of read-throughs, in the middle of rewrites, just like, hey, let's try this. Hey, let's try this. And because we had such an incredible creative team, there were no egos, and there was no one saying, no, you know, that's kind of a dumb idea, and, you know, I know how to do this best. Instead, it was this beautiful coming together where everybody said, great, let's try it. Great, let's try that. Great, let's try that. And I think it was that open mind that allowed us to end up with our best scenarios possible.
Yeah, and of course, obviously, so there's food placed around. The trick as well, without audience members getting in the way, is if we're polite enough, we will eat our cracker or have some popcorn or chips when you're not at the table performing a scene and wait for you to move along. Although I have to say, the night I was there, there were things of Necco wafers that were on the living room set. And I have to say, I really wanted one of those. So I wasn't going to walk on the set and grab it, but I kept looking at the Necco wafers. But David, let me ask you, as I said, there are parallel plot lines here. And my big fear, and I think it's a good idea to go with somebody because, I had a friend who was in the living room while I stayed in the dining room and switched around that way. But the good news is, and I think this is partially the way Leslie wrote it and partially the direction, if you hang with it, towards the end, things do come together and you will find yourself in the right place to get the outcome. Talk to me about, as a director, how you helped make that happen.
Well, it is very strange to talk about the show because it feels so innovative, and it felt very innovative to us while we were creating it. But it also seemed self-evident. There wasn't a lot of trial and error. There was, once we had the actors in and we were working in the space, it all flowed so easily. And that's because it's written. Leslie really did her job. There is a script. This is written. So a lot of our concern was actually more about timing, trying to discern what kind of scenes or how many scenes could go on at the same time. And then what bits of information somehow had to land in the clear. It is beautifully constructed in that Leslie's created a world in which people are introduced essentially a couple at a time as we go through. So we have four major introductions as our eight casts size gets introduced. And that reverses at the end. So you start with being able to focus on one couple, and then you're adding another couple. And there are only moments, and there are quite a few moments, but the first time that there are three conversations going on at once is about, 12 minutes into the show, and that is a time when suddenly the audience is faced with a choice, which is, oh, I get it. If I sit here, I can't hear everything, so I'm going to have to choose which one I follow.
Right.
But similarly, when you have about 12 minutes left of the show, things settle down and there's a certain group conscious where the party itself then focuses enough to resolve some of the plot issues or all of the plot issues that have been brought up. So if you really get confused and follow several stories during the course of the evening, just whatever strikes your fantasy, it is so well laid out and it is so well resolved that you will be able to understand the general scope of the evening just by sitting in one place and just seeing what you get throughout the course of the evening. The brilliant thing is we found that there are many audience members who want to come see the show more than once, so they can actually aggressively follow any one of the three or four storylines as it is going on. And that's also very exciting to see people who've been there before kind of getting a different perspective or listening to the show from a different angle.
And I was going to recommend that people consider seeing it. I want to see it again just because while I did get, you know, the various plot lines at the end, I by definition missed some scenes. So would love to go back and see that. Carly, I'm curious, you know, I know that the show is scripted, the lines are there, but I think maybe just because of the immersion effect, I'm sort of curious whether the actors have to create more backstory than you might typically do in a performance mode. You know, if you're playing whatever show you're doing, Sweet Charity, whatever it is, you know your role. But here, I mean, because we're part of this life, part of these relationships, did the actors get together and sort of have some backstory chat?
So we definitely do, and because of the length of the run, you know, we all share that dressing room, and we just chat, and we were, you know, things will come about like, well, what if Suzanne and Jackson, what if this is how they met, and what if this is how he proposed to her, or maybe she proposed to him. So yes, we definitely do have those discussions, and it does seem to be a bit more in-depth than any other preparation, just because we've had so many months together, and I am fortunate enough to have been in the ensemble as an understudy since the beginning. So I've been with the show for about 9 months, which is tremendous, and it's such a privilege. So
yeah, unless you're doing Hamilton, where do you get to play that role for that long, right? And by the way, Carly's my on point because you're there every show. Again, given, you know, do people ever like sit down in the living room? Sit down on the living room couch or just go places? Or if they do, are they just...
They will, and then we'll have our stage manager extraordinaire, Logan Jones, come to the rescue.
Gotcha.
And he will just kindly say, please stick to the benches along the sides of the room.
And there are benches savior along the side for you to observe, which was just so, so great. The night I was there, by the way, Suzanne Petrie and Bob Brewer were there.
That's wonderful.
Great actors themselves, and I've always been a huge Bob Brewer fan and stuff. And just to watch, I loved watching their face. I talked to them afterwards, but just their face as it went on, because as actors watching this, you got to be almost jealous, envious, whatever it is, to go, my God, would I love to be able to do something like this? Leslie, you ever going to write anything like this again, or was this a one shot deal? Is there version? Is there volume two of the immersion play?
We are in the beginning stages of a new show, so I'm currently writing a new script for Windy City. Fingers crossed for David as well. And it will be another immersive production.
Great. I would recommend in that one you serve some Twinkies. And I'm happy to be part of the menu committee to determine what gets. And I'm a junk food guy, so I won't do anything that'll break the budget. I'd be quite happy. And David, just for you, has this been one of the greater, you've done so many shows, so many different things. Has this been one of the greater challenges? I know it's been fun, but is it also a great challenge?
Yes. It's strange because the word challenge is a challenging word to deal with, because indeed it was probably one of the most joyous experiences that I've had in a very, very long time. There was really never any sense of either that things were not going to work or, even more importantly, conflict. It was just fully creative. All of us were engaged. This is the actors and all of the creative team engaged in trying to create a slightly different art form than places that art forms that we'd used before. So I truly felt like an old dog learning new tricks. And it was a wonderful feeling in the room that everyone was embracing all aspects of it pretty much all the time. It was a really extraordinary process. And so challenging, yes, only because the concept of it was new and radical, but not at all challenging, because it is the essence of what you want to do as a creative artist, which is be in the room with people who are able to contribute and respond creatively to anything that happened. And so the process was joyous in putting the show together.
I guess to quote Hamilton, if you want to be in the room where it happens, Southern Gothic is the show you've got to see. You literally are in the room where it happens. The show is playing at Windy City Playhouse, which is a little bit west. I mean, it's a little off the beaten path in terms of the theater district, but it's worth going out there to see it and to see this show. It's currently running till December 9th. I sure hope it gets extended for the millionth time, but I can't promise that. So if listeners want to go see it, you really got to get over there soon before December 9th. WindyCityPlayhouse.com is the website. You can follow them on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And it really is just it's an experience like I've never had. Nobody ever will. And I think there will be many that will follow you who will try and replicate what you have done because it is so successful. The address, I should say, is 3014 West Irving Park. So, hey, I had some pizza. There's a pizza place nearby, different places to eat around the neighborhood, so you can make an evening. And free parking in the neighborhood, believe it or not. I found just parking on the street. It was not tough. So I encourage everybody to check it out. Leslie Leotode, the playwright. I can't wait to see Volume 2. Please cast me in it.
thank you.
If you need a middle-aged anchor TV guy. And Carly Pollack, what a great job. And give your fellow cast members my regards. David Bell, congratulations to all of you on an incredible show. Southern Gothic at the Windy City Playhouse, windycityplayhouse.com. Do not miss it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Talk about your childhood wishes. You can even eat the dishes.
Who can take tomorrow?
Who can take tomorrow?
Dip it in a dream.
Separate the sorrow and collect up all the cream.
The Candyman.
Yes, the Candyman, iconic song. You all know that song, recorded by so many and covered by so many, but it is indeed from Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is now in Chicago and will be here through October 21st over at the Oriental Theater, compliments of Broadway in Chicago. I love the show. I've loved that. Maybe you saw the movie, the Gene Wilder version years ago. Maybe you saw the Johnny Depp version, and you probably read the original book because it is such a classic when you were a kid. It is for young and old alike. And it's my pleasure to chat with the choreographer of the show that is traveling around now, Joshua Burgas. Although he lives in New York, where he's a master teacher, he won an Emmy Award for, I think, one of the greatest shows of all time that I will never understand why it is not on the air to this day, and that is NBC's Smash. Do you agree with me that that was just a tragic that got canceled?
It was very sad. We were all very upset about it. We had a great time doing that show.
We're going to cry together some other time on that one, but his work can also be seen on So You Think You Can Dance. It's been on PBS with Sinatra, Voice for the Century. If you're a Broadway guy like I am, then you've seen his work in On the Town. He's gotten Tony Awards and nominations and just on and on and on. Let's talk about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Josh, thanks for spending some time with me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So, among many challenges, this one comes to you with the issue of it had been a book, it had been a couple of different movies. The first one, I'm not sure I'd call a musical as much as I might call a movie with music, but this one is indeed a Broadway musical. Talk to me about the importance of the choreography and presenting this classic story on stage.
The original production played in the West End first, and then Jack O'Brien and myself were asked to do an American version. And we looked at the West End version and realized that it didn't have the Gene Wilder film was the one that was really popular for us here in the States.
Sure.
And I think we wanted to do the American version that was a little more closely and aesthetically similar to the Gene Wilder film. So we made little changes and then we created a choreography that went to you almost travel to all the different locations as the golden ticket winners are found, the four kids before Charlie wins.
Right.
And so first, you know, we go to Bavaria where we meet the Gloops, and we did a Bavarian folk dance. And then when you meet Veruca in this version, she's Russian. And so we kind of do a ballet. And so what was fun about the choreography for this show was each number feels so different than the other numbers. Each one is so unique.
And the music here, I know there's original music by Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman, who, of course, are well known for Hair and just so many different things. They're so and Smash, by the way. It looks like Smash brought everybody together, right? Including Christian Borle. I mean, everybody came together from this one.
Yep, we were all in Smash together. That's right.
Yeah. But you also, I mean, some people would say, you know where I think Broadway makes a mistake sometimes is when there's a, I'm not going to say any show, names of shows, but there are some shows which have, say, iconic music attached to it. And then maybe as a movie or something like that. And then they get rid of all of it when it comes to stage for all the reasons they have for getting rid of it. But I think sometimes people come and they're disappointed because there's certain things they were hoping to hear. They want to see. It just comes with the territory. But for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, while Mark and Scott have written a new score, you still preserve the classic music people want to hear from Anthony Newley and Leslie Brickus.
We did. We preserved the three most popular songs, I think, from the movie, which are, of course, Candyman, I've Got a Golden Ticket, and Pure Imagination, because we knew that the audiences were expecting to hear those songs. And they're just, you know, they're wonderful songs, and they were written for this story, so they really work.
And you just anger people when they don't get to hear the music that they want to hear in these things. So I imagine as we see on stage, because it's soon to open, I'm going to be there. But, you know, you've got to create this beautiful land of Wonka. And, of course, in the movie that people will have, there's so many different tricky things. We've got the Oompa Loompas. How will people have the experience that they had, in appropriate for stage, but basically seeing the same kind of magic that they felt they were seeing in the film?
They sure will. That was one of, you know, our really tough assignments was how do we create that magic and you know, how it's a very difficult show because the first act, you're not inside the factory, and then the second act, you are. So it's almost like two completely different worlds. And so it makes it challenging. But, you know, I know that people are not going to be disappointed. They're not going to be disappointed with the chocolate room. They're not going to be disappointed with all the adventures that they go through in the factory. And they certainly will not be disappointed in the Oompa Loompas.
Now, something very classic in the movie. So I don't know. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but there was the great glass elevator. That's pretty critical. Do we lose that in the stage production?
Nope. There is the great glass elevator in the stage production.
Wow. So you make that happen as well.
Yep.
It sounds like the producers of this show said, we want everybody who saw this as a kid and every current kid to have the experience they did when they first saw this. That's what it sounds like.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's so iconic. All these elements of the show, of the movie and the book are so iconic. We knew that there was an expectation from the audience that to see that. And so we wanted to make sure we deliver on each expectation, and then hopefully surpass it.
Do you know, so Christian Borle, who played the role on Broadway, as you go to the national touring cast, and obviously you've been working with and training those who go on tour, do you find you have to make modifications to the choreography, to whatever, or is it a matter of, you know, these roles have certain expectations and the actors who play them will, you know, will handle it as Christian did, will handle it as anybody did on Broadway? How does that handle as you go from Broadway to national tour?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because when we, for the creators, we realized there were things that we did on Broadway that we looked at again and said, I think we can do better. And so we made improvements in our own work in the national tour. So I think the touring company, the touring production is one step above where the Broadway production was as far as the physical production, the ideas, the writing, the choreography. And then you get a whole new group of people, you know, very, very talented people, this new company that is performing in it. And what you want to do is you don't want to necessarily just replicate what you did before, but you want to see how does it work on them. And they bring new talents and new ideas to it. And you take that all into consideration so that it's something that is really built on them in a really positive way, and it's something that they have ownership of and don't feel like they've just been plugged into a machine.
And how would you describe your choreography style? Because you've done On the Town and Sweet Charity, so you've dealt with Fosse work in the past, and other greats. So in Charlie, where I'm guessing you get to kind of do your own thing, did you use anybody as an inspiration for the choreography here?
Well, you know, my biggest inspiration is always the story. And like I was saying before, you travel, you go to a different location every time. So there's choreography, there's Bavarian folk dancing, there's ballet, there's a classic Broadway number, there's a big Act One showstopper, and then there's a lot of character work, there's Oompa Loompa choreography. So I think in this show, it wasn't all about one style. It was about what is the story, how would these characters move, and then the second big inspiration for me is the score. And when Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman write songs, you can almost picture the movement and the staging.
Yeah,
it's just it makes it so easy for me as a choreographer to choreograph to one of their songs.
And you'd work together in Smash, so obviously there was also a chemistry already there.
Yes, totally. I really understand how they work and the style of their music. I was also in the original cast of Hairspray, so I got to know them back then. And, when I was in that cast, I always wished I would get the opportunity to work with them as a choreographer. So this is kind of almost a full circle dream come true.
Must have been a fun time choreographing Harvey Firestein.
Oh, yeah. No, but I was in the cast.
That's what I'm saying. But it must have been hard for the choreographer to work with Harvey. No, I love Harvey.
He's incredible.
Just think of the master dancers. And by the way, point of personal privilege, I think you worked with another good friend of mine and yours, Casey Lyons, when you did Hazel here at Drury Lane.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. What a great experience.
Casey is
wonderful.
Casey is the son of our now former news director here at WGN. And
really?
So, yeah. So I went out there to see him. And, of course, he just toured in Love Never Dies. National tour. He's back home now, but I will extend your regards if I may.
Yeah,
he's quite the talent.
Please send my love. He is very talented, talented young man.
He really is, and I tell him that I'm responsible for his success. I don't. Maybe he'll believe him. He's young. Anyway, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is playing over at the Oriental Theater, and it's only here till October 21st because, of course, they just keep going from city to city, right? Is it they got to pack everything up and move it from one city to another? I imagine the cast just kind of goes with the flow.
That's exactly right. It's on a they're on tour for at least a year, and they're hitting some great cities. I think, Chicago is being basically our first city. We set the tour up in Buffalo, New York, and then Chicago is really our big opening.
Ah.
And then from there, I think, they travel to Cincinnati, Toronto, they go out west to LA and San Diego. So they have some really great stops.
But like every good pre-Broadway show, which starts in Chicago, even the national tour should absolutely stop in Chicago as well as it should.
That's right.
You got it. Over at the Oriental Theater until October 21st. Tickets, BroadwayInChicago.com. Josh, thanks for your time. I sure appreciate it. One day I'll have you choreograph me maybe here on set of my political show. That'll be interesting.
That sounds fun.
And we're going to go out with a little more music that you will know and we will all know from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which you don't want to miss. Josh Bagas, thanks so much for your time. We'll see what's next up for you. I should ask you that. What's your next project?
My next project, we're going to go do Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in Australia.
Ah.
So we're going to go in November and set up another company in Australia. And I've never been, so I'm very excited.
You are going to love it. I'll give you some things to do.
Okay, sounds great.
Thank you, Josh. I appreciate your time. Here's a little more music from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
There is no life I know to compare with your imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be.
Well, and after all that theater, I wanted to share with you an event coming up. Very important, especially, I think, in the some would argue, in the times we live in. And it is the 25th anniversary of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And on October 15th, 2,000 Chicagoans are going to get together at the Sheraton Grand Chicago for the annual luncheon, which is called What You Do Matters. I've attended this for the last few years, and it's really a very powerful experience because there's Holocaust survivors present, scholars, and people just from the community who just believe that this mission needs to go on, and we want to talk about why it is so important. Joining me to discuss this is Jill Weinberg. She's the executive director of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's Midwest office. And then we've got a couple of honorees on the with us as well here. Peter Hayes, he's an author. He's been teaching information about the Holocaust atrocities for many years. He's taught at Northwestern for decades. Lots of books on this topic, and something special I'll say in a minute. And also Father John Polakowski, who spent 40 years changing the views of how Catholics and others view the Holocaust, improving Catholic-Jewish relations. So my warm welcome and thanks to all of you for joining me very much. The little surprise was that Father John, hope I'm not blowing anything, but Father John and Peter Hayes, you're going to be honored at the luncheon this year. So as we were chatting before we went on, I have to say, I'll start with you, Father John. How do you get a Catholic priest honored at essentially this Jewish affair here? That's pretty good.
Well, of course, it's not totally a Jewish event because the mission of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum also includes the other victims of the Nazis. And to some extent, when I was brought on to the original board of the museum and then subsequently served three further terms by presidential appointment, I was brought on to some extent because of my work in Catholic-Jewish relations, but also because of my Polish-American background, the Poles being probably the second most important victim group of the Nazis.
Yeah, because a lot of people talk about, certainly from the Jewish community, as I am, we talk about the 6 million killed, but there were 12 million killed,
approximately. Yes.
Yeah, in this atrocity. Peter Hayes, speaking of being honored with a question, you are, I know, a Boston Irishman. So explain how that guy shows up at this lunch.
Oh well, that guy was born right after the Second World War and came of age in the early '60s when the American Civil Rights Movement was at its height, and so I was sensitized to the issue by watching the struggle of African Americans for racial equality on my television every night. And I grew up in a town where many of the guys I played baseball with and so forth were Jews. And so I found it very difficult to understand why this group of people was the target of hostility. And so that's where it all started. And then I just read. And the more I read, the more I was fascinated by trying to explain how history can go so badly wrong in this fashion.
Yeah.
And that's been the story of my academic life.
Jill, I want to ask you the purpose of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. And here's the thing. I think for years, a lot of people look at this and say, well, it's there to it's there to memorialize what happened during World War II, to make sure people never forget, and especially for those who are deniers, to show them that this was an event that happened in time. But I started off this interview with a comment about kind of the times in which we live, and it seems as though the purpose of the Holocaust Memorial Museum has taken on even greater import in today's times.
Well, when this museum was conceived, and I have been involved with the museum for 30 years, and as many of us know, this year is a milestone because it is the museum's 25th anniversary, which is so extraordinary, and I'd be happy to talk more about the significance of that and the role that Chicago has played. But when this museum was conceived well over 30 years ago, I don't think even those of us who believed in it so greatly could have imagined its relevance today. And the fact that the questions that the museum asked today seem so incredibly timely there's a new exhibit that just opened at the museum on Americans and the Holocaust. And the questions are about what did America do? What happened with the ability to bring in the refugees? And at that point, there were the possibilities of continuing to rescue people, but this country didn't do what it could do. And so, of course, those questions remain so relevant today.
You know, when the Holocaust Museum opened in Skokie, I did a special on it called Site of Remembrance and got to meet people like Fritzy Fritschel and Sam Harris. I know all of you guys, I'm sure, know those survivor names. And you hear these stories, and it's just astounding. Aaron Elster as well. I grew up in Skokie, I should tell you. So I grew up in a neighborhood where pretty much all of my neighbors were Holocaust survivors. I do not come from a family of Holocaust survivors, but my neighbors all were. And Father John, I have to say, what important role, in your opinion, do those who are the voice of the past, who were at this point children at the time, how important are they to get the message out that you try to send, which is to improve relations?
Well, I think we realize how easily relations among peoples can deteriorate. I mean, one of the big lessons for me from the Holocaust is how a society that many considered one of the most advanced yet produced by humanity broke down so easily, and how people who had very good social relations, who were the piano teachers of their children, they quickly became opponents of these people. People disowned them. People allowed the political regime to get rid of them and incarcerate them, to marginalize them, and so on. So social marginalization can easily penetrate a society, and I think the Holocaust gives us a very good contemporary window to how that comes about.
Peter Hayes, what do you do through your teaching, your work, to fight anti-Semitism today? You'd think we'd be beyond that in this society, but we're not.
No, we're not. I think human beings have a tendency to take shortcuts, and one of the expressions of that is that they generalize about other people or other groups of people. And we have to be constantly on the alert to fight that, to serve as antidotes to the human tendency to reduce individuals to categories, to remind people that most suppositions about other ethnic or religious groups and so forth amount really to generalizations that verge on superstition. And that's what we have to keep. That's the message we have to keep sending. It's an endless battle because of that human tendency to categorize others as a separate group with which the individuals have no sympathy. And that's the mission of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's the mission of those of us who teach in the field.
And Jill, the museum's in Washington, D.C. I mean, the main museum people know about is Washington. There is one, as I said, here in Skokie, which makes total sense as a home of Holocaust survivors. But here, this luncheon coming up on October 15th, it's in Chicago. Let me just ask you briefly, what is the importance of the Chicago community in this mission, and how can people locally help out, aside from going to a luncheon?
So you are absolutely correct that this is the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, located on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. And the symbolism of that cannot be stated strongly enough, that our country, on the most visible and priceless piece of land, decided to build a memorial to the victims of the Holocaust. But it wasn't just a memorial that they were building. It was truly an education center. And a young woman in our community, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, a number of years ago said, "The museum is really, truly a global classroom." And that was one of the best descriptions for what this museum is. And you spoke about the museum in Skokie, and there are many, many, many local museums across the country, all that play very significant roles in the community and that are so important. And there is only one United States Holocaust Memorial Museum that works cooperatively, collectively with all of these other projects to help them to bring exhibits that we create in Washington to the regions, that helps them to prepare teacher training programs and law enforcement programs and all the myriad of activities that the museum does and the training that it does. So we really do believe in these local and national efforts and see the significance of all of them. So there are many ways that people here in Chicago have played roles. They have donated their artifacts to the museum in Washington. The really strong piece about the museum in Washington is its permanence, that we have a guarantee that this museum will stand for as long as this country stands, and that is very, very, very affirming to making sure that we continue to support it and make sure that it is able to bring the lessons of the Holocaust to the generations ahead that will not have those firsthand experiences with Holocaust survivors that you had growing up in Skokie.
Agreed. Peter Hayes, Father John, and Jill Weinberg, thank you for joining me. The luncheon is October 15th at the Sheraton Grand. What you do matters. That's the theme of the lunch. See Peter and Father John getting honored. Jill, for people who want to get tickets or check it out, what website can they go to?
They can go to ushmm.org, and they can call our office at 847-433-8099. That's 847-433-8099.
With my thanks to all three of you for being with us. I hope the lunch is sold out, as it almost always is, I know. And I can promise people who attend, it's an experience you won't forget as you both listen to the speakers and interact with the survivors and others who are there. It's an incredible experience. And I'm glad you hold it every year. And I look forward to attending future luncheons as well. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.